So I am interviewing Tony Wong for the Chinese Jamaican Oral History Project. The date is November 6, 2018, and myself, the interviewer, is Danny Fisher. Tony, can you tell us when and where you were born?
I was born in April 18th, 1963, in Montego Bay, Jamaica.
Can you tell us about your parents and sort of your family background?
Sure. My mom and my dad were both born in China, in sort of the Bao'an region of China, which most people know now as Shenzhen, or the New Economic Zone. My mom left in 1930. She was 20 years old when she left. Sorry, let me take that back. 1930, 1950, when she was 20 years old. That's dating her a little. And she left for Jamaica. She didn't actually really know where she was going. It was an arranged marriage with my dad, who had left China a few years earlier. When she got there, actually, she tells a story of having to take this really arduous journey, and part of it was by boat. She remembers being in a boat, getting off at the port of Miami. Actually, she wasn't physically allowed to get off at the port of Miami because she, you know, was on American soil. But some people would throw fruit on the boat, and she remembers eating this delicious fruit. And I'm trying to remember what it was now, but it was, she thought it was the most horrible thing she'd ever eaten, because she had forgotten to peel it. She didn't know what it was. But anyway, from there, she took a plane to Montego Bay, where she was supposed to meet my dad. And my dad couldn't meet her in Kingston because Kingston and Montego Bay are, you know, pretty far away, especially those days when you didn't have the highways that we have now. And he had sent actually a much older friend. So my mom remembers seeing this really old gentleman, probably in his 60s, come meet her at the airport. And she completely freaked out, thinking that was my dad. And, you know, he was calling her name and she refused to reply. That's, she thought she was just gonna hop back on that plane and get right back to China. So anyway, that was her first entree into Montego, Kingston, and eventually Montego Bay. They opened up a grocery store in Montego Bay, and they, like many Chinese immigrants, lived above the grocery store. And you know, the grocery store was underneath. They had five kids. I was the youngest. I have three sisters and a brother. We all worked in the grocery store, although to be truthful, I ate more candy than I actually, you know, sold. But it was a really incredible upbringing, really. In fact, I distinctly remember I was probably 5 or 6 years old because we actually lived in a grocery store that, you know, I didn't have the concept that people drank anything but Pepsi. It was the weirdest thing. I remember, you know, because after school I would go home, I would, you know, go into the grocery store and drink a couple Pepsis and eat a patty, which we sold, and Cracker Jack, or you know, banana chips. And I remember going to a friend's house, and he said, "Do you want something to drink?" And he would open the fridge, and he had some chilled water in the fridge. And I completely freaked out. I remember this. I was like 6 or 7 years old. And, you know, in my mind, I was thinking, "Oh my God, people drink water as a beverage." I never realized that. It was just like the biggest shock that people actually just drank water. Because I grew up in a grocery store, all I ever drank was Pepsi. And to this day, you know, I probably drink maybe 6 or 7 pops a day, unfortunately. You know, I don't drink water. Well, not intentionally anyway. So that was what it was like growing up in this grocery store. The house actually was this sort of concrete bunker, right? I describe it as looking, having all the charm of a nuclear bunker. And that's what it was. It was just this concrete block housing, and we lived on top. Never felt deprived. I mean, we had an incredible, I had an incredible childhood, certainly. Went to an Anglican school, St. James Preparatory in Montego Bay. The teachers were British. You did get tired of singing Michael Row the Boat Ashore every day for 5 days straight, though, every week. But the great thing is, our teacher, Mrs. Price, introduced us to, and Mrs. Gentles, introduced us to incredible works of art, you know, C.S. Lewis. She would read to us C.S. Lewis and the theology of C.S. Lewis. She would read just about everything. My dad was also an avid reader, so the great thing is we had a library where you're allowed to take 2 books a week from home. And so my dad and I basically read every single Nancy Drew and every single Hardy Boys. Actually, after we finished Hardy Boys, we read every single Nancy Drew, and then we would read Tom Swift, which was by the same imprint. It was really a fabulous kind of childhood. I left when I was 11. We immigrated to Canada, to Etobicoke, where I lived with my cousins for the first couple years in grade 8. Because Jamaica is under the British system, it's actually a couple years ahead or more advanced than the typical system. So I was 11 years old, but I went straight to grade 8, although technically I would have been in grade 6. So the kids were a lot bigger, and I remember the first class was hockey, or it was gym, and it was hockey. And I remember, because I couldn't skate, they would put me in goal and shoot pucks at me. And to this day, I still don't watch hockey. I hate that bloody game. So that's one thing I'm not very Canadian about. But yeah, it was an incredible experience. Humber Valley Village would lead to Richview Collegiate in Etobicoke, which is where the former Prime Minister Stephen Harper went as well. And in fact, he and his brother Grant used to play in the basement of my cousin's house. They used to play ball hockey in the basement. I never played because I hated hockey. But they would come over and play hockey. In fact, many years later, Stephen Harper would give my cousin his Toronto Star Stephen Harper would give my cousin his Toronto Star carrier route. And I would introduce Stephen Harper again many decades later at the Chinese Cultural Center, where he was opening a new edition, by saying he used to work for the Toronto Star, which I'm sure made him very happy. And he came over after and he asked, you know, how's your cousin Robert? And he even asked about that little wagon that he used to have. And I called up Robert and I said, Stephen Harper wants to know about that little red wagon that he gave you for his star carrier route. And Robert said, oh, that bugger, he made me pay $20 in goodwill for that damn wagon. Anyway, so it was a really interesting upbringing. That was in Etobicoke. It was really fabulous. And it was an interesting time in the 70s because Canada was really opening up, and it was accepting, under sort of, you know, the Trudeau government, of multiculturalism and this whole, you know, new wave of immigration, which really transformed the city. Except we didn't know we were transforming the city. We were just like, wow, this is cool. Where am I? You have more, you know, I mean, it went from one channel, a one channel universe, Jamaica Broadcasting Corporation, to a multi-channel universe in Canada. And for me, and now I'm now the television critic at the Star, that was an amazing thing. Of course, I promptly stopped reading books and just watched TV brainlessly for the rest of my life. But, you know, that was my experience. Those were the early days.
Yeah. What was the move like for you, 11 years old, that you must remember a lot of growing up in Jamaica and then obviously a lot of growing up here? So it's a nice split in terms of time spent there, time spent here, in terms of your upbringing.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It wasn't... I must say it wasn't major culture shock. You know, Jamaica was well, the school I went to in Jamaica was very multicultural anyway, and it was British, and the students were multicultural. So from all walks of life, and of course the Jamaican motto is out of many one people. So there were many. It was already a very diverse, I felt, at least within the school, a fairly diverse community. So when I came to Canada, it wasn't major culture shock. I was super excited. I was sad to leave my friends, but when you're 11 years old, it was like, holy macaroni, you know, you've got more than one channel on television. That is like, oh my God, that's bonkers. And, you know, the selection of you know, ice cream you can get in the supermarket. I mean, when you're 11 years old, that's all you can think about. Really, it's not the fact that your mom is 2,000 miles away and you're living with your relatives. But it was really, really a cool experience. I think, you know, I would visit my sisters on the weekend, and the thing I would do every Friday, and it's not something I would even imagine I would do with my own kids. I don't have kids, but if I had nieces or nephews, at 11 years old, I would take the subway from Etobicoke to North York, but, you know, do a stop in downtown Toronto on Dundas Street to play pinball and go to the Imperial Six, which was actually the first multiplex in Canada where you had more than one screen playing movies. And I would basically sit there all day and go from one movie to the next, or trying to sneak in from one movie to the next. And I was 11 years old. You know, of course, that was the same time that there was this famous shoeshine boy who died through sexual assault. So there was a dark, it was a dark period where before they cleaned up Yonge Street, which was, I guess, our equivalent to Times Square then. But, you know, when you're 11, it was all very exciting. In fact, I remember sitting in front of one show, which was restricted, Brian De Palma's Carrie. And I sat right in the front row. And this was the first time, one of the first times that they used a dream sequence. Now it's very common, but at the end of the show, there's a dream sequence where Carrie, comes back from the dead and her arm pops out of the grave. And I'm in the front row. Her arm pops out of the grave. I jump right out of my seat. I'm supposed to be 18, not 11. Start screaming and run out of the theater. I remember that so vividly. But that was my experience. And also I used a fake mustache I got from Pizza Hut in Charleston, West Virginia when I visited my... And I used a University of Guelph jacket and I brought a briefcase in. So that all that got me into Carrie at the age of 11. So that was, you know, really brilliant. It was really a great childhood. And then we went to, for high school, I went to, it was called Overly Secondary School back then. Now it's called Marc Garneau Collegiate. That was in East York. Multicultural. In fact, that area and that postal code is probably the poorest in Toronto now. There's a lot of refugees in that area. And certainly it was very poor back then, you know, a lot of first generation immigrants. And I've always meant to take a look at my class, because it was such an interesting period where just looking at our high school reunion, out of the class of 30, you've got like 10 doctors, 4 lawyers, a really interesting mix of first generation kids whose parents never went to university, but they really had to succeed. This was sort of that initial push, that initial backbone for that multicultural drive that we now know as Toronto, or that really transformed the city decades later through themselves and through their kids. But there were quite a few Chinese Jamaicans going to Overly, I remember. Actually, my cousin lived with us, Walter Chin. Walter is probably, he was considered the top fashion photographer in Canada later on. And he also he shoots for Vogue and GQ and has exhibitions at the Guggenheim. So he's really a well-known fashion photographer. You know, he was a few years ahead of us. He lived with us while we were in at Overly. So it really had a huge impact on me. And it really showed me the promise of what Canada could be, I think. I think that school was really formative for me. And everybody was on an equal footing and anybody could do anything. And I think that was the really amazing thing about that upbringing. Now, having said that, it was a really weird transition in the sense that, you know, I was obviously ethnically Chinese, but I didn't speak the language, or at least I spoke Hakka at home, because you had to speak Hakka or your grandmother wouldn't feed you. So you had to speak Hakka, but Hakka is a minority dialect. The dialect that Canadians at the time spoke was initially Toisan, and then the second wave was Cantonese, and the third wave was Mandarin. Now, I didn't speak any of those dialects, so I was essentially a minority within a minority. So yes, there were a lot of Chinese kids at Overly, but I couldn't really relate to them or to a certain extent even speak their language, even though English, of course, was a shared common language. At the same time, you know, I wasn't black, but I identified with a lot of the black students because I grew up in Jamaica. So it was kind of interesting to have all those facets. And it wasn't until many years later I discovered that it was really an advantage, not a disadvantage, to be multifaceted. But at the time, it was like, oh my God, what the hell am I? You know, trying to find that identity. So when you're a kid, you do have that identity crisis because you can't really find that comfortable niche. You don't know what that niche is. You don't know who you are. And so it was difficult in the early years. Sorry.
Yeah. Could I ask you to dwell on that a little bit more? That's really... Mm-hmm.
Sorry, let me just...
No, please.
Yeah. So I think what's interesting now is that, you know, we've all heard of fusion food and, you know, how it's so trendy. You know, I remember one of our greatest chefs, Suser Lee, going to his restaurant, you know, over 20 years ago, and people were raving about this guy who combined Chinese and Western elements, and nobody had heard of this. And you'd go in there and he'd take a steak and he'd pour oyster sauce over it and charge you $50. And it was like, what? What the hell is he doing? He's cooking the exact same steak my mom did. And then I realized that, you know, while fusion is sort of a trendy word, in some cases, it's a dirty word now in some cultural circles. While fusion is kind of a trendy word, that's what we were years ago. We were fusion. You know, we had elements of the African diaspora, the Chinese diaspora, the Canadian diaspora. But that's what essentially made us Canadian, because we're all from somewhere else and we all had elements of somewhere else. And that was an incredible advantage and something to be proud of. Not something to, you know, be not proud of or be ashamed of. Although in the early years, I wouldn't say I was ashamed. It was just, I just didn't know what the heck I was. And in fact, even taking that further, trying to figure out who you are. I mean, because, you know, I've always been displaced, but I never really knew it. So growing up in Jamaica, I was always in a land where I was a minority. I never really felt oppressed or even really felt like a minority. Although there was one time I really discovered I wasn't black when I remember I was a kid. Some other kids were throwing windows up. Sorry. I did feel displaced when I was a kid when some other kids were throwing pebbles at the window. And then I'd run outside and I'd say, you know, what the heck's happening? Why are you throwing pebbles at me? And then they would start screaming, "The Chinese boy to come, the Chinese boy to come." And meaning the Chinese boy is coming. And then I would look around and going, "Who the hell are you talking about?" Then I realized they were talking about me, which was probably the first realization that I wasn't black. But coming back to that theme, you know, it's kind of interesting that I grew up in Jamaica, where I was obviously a minority, came to Canada, where I was a minority. I never really felt like a minority, but I didn't realize that being a minority, there is, I think oppression is too big a word, but there is a sense that you don't really fully belong. And I remember going to Asia for the first time and then, you know, just walking in the streets and seeing that I looked like everybody else and I blended in and nobody, you know, gave 2 cents about me and I didn't stick out. And I was like, wow, that's what it feels like to be the majority. That's incredible. And, you know, I didn't do that till I was 17 when I was in Taiwan trying to learn Mandarin at the university for a few months. So that was a weird revelation. And then many years later, going to Hong Kong and being at a bar. And I was at this bar and with another friend, and somebody asked me to dance. And I was thinking, wow, this is what happens to a white guy when he goes to a bar. That's brilliant. You know, I never even, you know, I would never imagine, blew my mind. So even having grown up in Jamaica, then having grown up in Canada, being a minority and being a minority within a minority, I didn't even know what that meant until I sort of got out of my own skin and started traveling. So that was interesting to me.
Can I ask you to sort of comment about the Chinese Jamaican community broadly? You know, obviously you're giving us a lot of wonderful material about your personal experience, but obviously the community is something that you show up for, that you write about. Can you just talk a little bit about your connection to the sort of broader Chinese Jamaican community?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. There are a lot of Chinese Jamaicans and, in fact, Caribbean Chinese in Canada. I mean, they're Trinidadian. In fact, I have cousins from Trinidad, Jamaica, Guyana. So they're all over the GTA in particular. There's a big diaspora. It's interesting. I don't know exactly how many there are, there'd be tens of thousands, I would imagine, across Canada. I haven't done an actual look, but there is a significant community, and there used to be a beauty pageant, there used to be dinners and. There used to be all sorts of things. It was really a community where sort of you initially gathered, I guess not unlike the very early Tong associations that the Chinese would form during the turn of the century to sort of, you know, whether it's the Tong associations, of course, are associations that were built on the last names of the family, and they would be everything from an informal banker to a community center. That evolved over the years, obviously, and certainly the Chinese Jamaican crowd would also be part of that diaspora. You know, growing up being Chinese Jamaican in Toronto, it's really been an interesting ride because it's a really interesting pocket of a community that most people don't know about. And I've always had an association. There've been, you know, it's really a community within itself. It's got its own retail shops. It's got its own organizations. It's got its own, you know, beauty pageants. It's got its own, Christmas events. It's really an organization. Well, I wouldn't call it an organization. It's really a community. That most people, as I was saying, don't know about, but I think it's really one of the most interesting communities in the city. Well, everybody thinks their community is the most interesting community, but I really think it's this really diverse community. It's you know, by its nature, it's a fusion community of many different communities. And I think that kind of melting pot is really, multicultural melting pot is really fascinating. I wrote about being Chinese and Jamaican and the star in the 80s. And I was probably, I'm sure I was the first because nobody else cared about the Chinese Jamaican community. But I was really writing about myself. And I think, you know, with most writers, you kind of write what you know. And years later, I've been at the Star over 30 years. Years later, that's translated it into pretty much the same thing. You know, it turns out I didn't know much, but I'm still mining my past. I was once asked, I'm the TV critic at the Toronto Star right now, and I was once asked, well, why do you write so much about your community? Why do you write so much about being Asian? And I said, well, you know, John Doyle, who's Irish over at the Globe, who's a TV critic, can write all day long about being Irish and nobody bats an eye. So I see no reason why, you know, I can't write about being Asian. So I think there's been a bit of a balance in the universe. But certainly the Chinese Jamaican community is fundamental to certainly who I am. And it's really impacted me and how I write over the years and how I approach my writing, I think. And it's also given me a much deeper understanding into communities, you know, and minorities and diversity. I think that is a gift that just doesn't stop giving.
When you mentioned it affecting your writing, do you mean in that the ability to appreciate multifaceted things sort of translates into writing, or did you mean that another way?
Yeah, I think it certainly influences how I write. It influences, I guess, my worldview growing up being Chinese and Jamaican. It certainly helped me in my reporting over the years, in reaching out to the community. In my early days, I was a crime reporter. There was a lot of especially during the early days when the black community had issues with the police, it was very hard to reach out to certain segments of the community because there was mistrust. And certainly that still goes on today, but it was even more, I think it was even more inflamed back then. And it would allow me access in some ways I don't think I would have if I weren't Jamaican. I remember one time I interviewed Sophia Cook. She was shot by a Toronto police officer. And I got the first interview with her because basically, her parents didn't trust anybody else. And I was one of the few, Jamaican voices at the time at the newspaper. In fact, and I think that certainly helped me gain access. When I started at the Star in 1987, I was actually the first reporter of Chinese descent to work at the paper. And, you know, it's kind of ludicrous when you think about it because the Star is the largest newspaper in Canada. And it took until 1987 for somebody to be on staff, which I think is preposterous. But that's the environment that we worked in back then.
Could I ask you to talk a little bit about arriving at the Star and sort of your work life in advance of the Star? So that's over 30 years with the Star. So I'm sort of curious what came before. And obviously you alluded to television, your interest in television sort of blossoming when you came here. Can you kind of connect all the dots for us to where you are now?
Sure. I did my undergraduate degree in English at the University of Toronto. And then after U of T, I did my graduate degree in journalism at Ryerson. From there, I worked freelance for different publications, London Free Press, CBC Radio, and then eventually found myself as an intern at the Star, where I got hired. in 1987 and where I've been till now. It was an interesting evolution. You know, at the start, I did basically everything. Well, everybody does everything. It's called general assignment when you first start in newspapers, and it was great training. You covered cats up trees, fires, city hall. You did everything. But later on, I did a number of beats. I was at City Hall for a long time. And when I started, I had no idea who the alderman was. I couldn't tell the alderman from the garbage man. I had no idea what was going on. I went from City Hall to Queen's Park during the Bob Rae years. I covered crime. I was a feature writer. I spent many years as a business writer. And in between, I wrote for just about every section because I really am interested in a lot of different things. For example, if I could do anything tomorrow, I'd be a tennis writer, if there was such a thing as a tennis writer. But I would beg the sports editor to send me to Wimbledon or the US Open while I was a business writer so that I could cover sports. And I just really loved that. And in between, I would write for different sections like wheels because, you know, I loved cars. So I would, you know, just drive cars around. Life for food or entertainment, where I did movie reviews. I was a backup guy for the Star's movie reviewer many years back. To now, where I'm the TV critic, where I basically binge watch Netflix all day and they actually pay me, and it is actually a real job, and it's a great job. Unfortunately, you end up with zero core conditioning, and that's not a good thing. But it's, you know, it's been an incredible journey. It's not a journey, though, that's as accessible anymore, and that's kind of sad because, you know, newspapers are sadly going the way of the dodo. And if you look at best jobs out there, I think newspapers are 160 out of 160. So not a good trend, unfortunately. But yeah, it's been an incredible journey. And I think the great thing about newspapering is that you're constantly going to school. So for 3 or 4 years, you're, you know, trying to figure out what the heck is a Queen's Park, what is provincial government. You know, another few years, you might... you know, be trying to learn the television business or whatever. And I think it's a really great way to learn about the world.
Did you always know you were interested in working in newspapers and writing, or was it sort of something that was nurtured or encouraged?
Well, I was the only Chinese kid in school, it seems, that couldn't add. So I had no choice. I think I had to go get an English degree. I mean, it was sink or swim. But I was fortunate, you know. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, you know, doing that initial English degree at U of T. I kind of floundered around because what could you do with an English degree? I wasn't even sure. I knew I kind of wanted to write, so then I went to and wrote for the student newspapers like the Varsity. I formed my own newspaper through the Chinese Students Union, which was the first, it was called Dialogue, which was the first English newspaper put out by the Chinese Students Union at U of T. I did a reggae show at U of T Radio. And in fact, people would walk up the flights at the Varsity building to try and find the DJ. And then they'd see me and they'd think, well, that's the engineer. Where's the DJ? Which was kind of funny. So yeah, I did different kinds of things in media while I was doing my undergraduate degree in English at U of T, but I wasn't sure if you could actually make money doing that. And it wasn't until I went to Ryerson after that it kind of honed what I wanted.
Yeah. Can I ask you about family now? You know, do you have many connections with family from Jamaica, from elsewhere? How about your community here in Canada?
Oh, yeah, I've got, you know, three sisters and a brother. My brother is still in Jamaica. In fact, I wrote about my brother many years ago in the Toronto Star's business section. It was called, well, the title of the article was How My Brother Became the Condom King of the Caribbean. And what happened was, he used to sit on the AIDS hospices of Jamaica, and they realized that there was an AIDS problem. And it wasn't being addressed because a lot of kids weren't wearing condoms. And the condoms then were being marketed to, it wasn't really being marketed. They'd have like a Farrah Fawcett type figure on the pack of the condom. And, you know, they'd try and market it to a Caribbean culture. That didn't work. My brother used to be the art director at 17 Magazine. So he understood that there was a marketing issue. Everything for him is a marketing issue. But what he did was he formed a condom company and put on Carlene, the dancehall queen, which was sort of the hottest dancehall star at the time on the cover, had our cousin Walter shoot her in New York. The best-selling condom in the Caribbean was born. Unfortunately, my mother didn't know anything about this. So I would bring her down and she'd go into the storeroom for the first time and see 100 boxes of condoms. And then she'd go, well, what's this? And then my wife, Sharon, and I would go, well, okay, it's time to go now because there's going to be trouble. And we'd take off and head to the nearest Sandals because, you might as well, condom king, crack cocaine king, it's the same deal. To my mother who convinced us that we were, immaculately conceived. So, that was part of the whole deal. So my brother is still around. He still has a condom company. In fact, they just finished doing every year, he steals marketing from everybody else's ideas. So, the Pirelli pinup calendar, he'll do as a slam condom calendar, so in fact, he just finished doing that where I'm in Markham now and I have to write the blurbs to the calendar from Markham. Miss January loves jerk pork and dance hall, classics like that. But it's all been for a good cause. Much of the proceeds are donated to AIDS research, and I think it's made a bit of a difference. So, but that was his little sideline when he wasn't running my mom's grocery store. He downsized from being an art director in New York and went back and he wanted to just dabble in egg tempera and, be a real artist. And so he went back to Montego Bay, taking his wife with him at the time, who was the former chief copywriter at Macy's. So you have these two very urban people heading back to sell condensed milk in the shop. So, full circle.
Yeah. Are you close to him or particularly close to any of your siblings or all of them?
Oh, yeah, we're very close. We have dinners and family dinners all the time. My brother comes up every year. I haven't been to Jamaica in years, though. It's something I should do, but I've been traveling the world so much that it's just not... going back to your own backyard is kind of weird. I mean, for example, I'm going to Morocco next month, and I was in Vietnam earlier this year. So it's... It's maybe someplace I'd like to retire to one day, but we'll have to see. But yeah, I mean, I'm essentially an incredibly lazy person. And I think being on a beach in Montego Bay would sort of be a nice way to end things.
Could I ask, since part of the oral history, is, I think, to help people with genealogy, historical questions, could I ask you to say their names so we...
Oh, sure, of course. My brother's name is Victor Wong. My sister, the eldest sister, is Evelyn Liu. The second sister is Cherry Wong. And then there's Jennifer Chin.
Thank you. And also your parents, their names?
It's Lily Wong and Lester Wong.
Thank you. I wanted to actually backtrack quickly, if I could, and ask you, you mentioned your father was already in Kingston when your mother came. Was he born and raised in Jamaica, or did he have a kind of coming over from China himself, or...
Yeah, no, my dad was actually from China. I don't know exactly what age he left China. I think it was maybe he was 13 or 14 when he left China. But he came from a village called Fuhang. My mom came from a village called Chunlenha. And they weren't that far from each other, but they didn't know each other. And it was an arranged marriage my dad's brother actually went to school in Chunlenha with my mom. And so that was how the connection was made between the two of them. And I did take my mom back to her village in China, 46 years after she had left. And it had changed so much that the funny thing is that when she left, you know, the Japanese were still there because obviously it was, the Sino-Japanese War. And she had, real horror stories to tell about that time. But the funny thing is, where she is now, or right near her village, is probably the largest golf course complex in the world, and it's full of Japanese. So she left, the Japanese were there, and she comes back, and the Japanese are still there. So again, full circle.
Did you know grandparents on... either side, and much about sort of ancestry in your family?
My mom's, I didn't really know my dad's grandparents because they passed away, but I did know my mom's parents. My mom's dad ended up in Dutch Suriname, and from there he immigrated to Amsterdam, where he passed away in Amsterdam. My grandmother died in Toronto. She used to live with us. And that's how I know most of my Chinese, most of my Hakka, because I had to speak to her in Hakka. And if you wanted to eat, you had to, speak Hakka. So it was really good. I think we had a really great relationship, between my mom. And although what happened during the war is that my grandmother and my grandfather were separated during the war. So they didn't really know where each other were. My grandmother ended up in Jamaica. My grandfather was in Suriname. And then when he immigrated to Holland, it was mass confusion, obviously. But they did eventually find each other again. And it was a great moment.
Thank you. And then you mentioned Sharon. Is there anything you can tell us about how you two met? And
oh, sure. Sharon was doing the same master's in journalism program at Ryerson that I was doing, but she was doing it, many years later. Her parents are from China as well. They speak Toisan. She was a crime reporter at the Toronto Sun, and then eventually was the medical and science reporter at the Toronto Sun. She's since retired, but I probably knew friends of each other. I guess we knew each other from mutual friends over the years. And she was actually the first Asian reporter at the Toronto Sun when she started, which I think was, if I'm not mistaken, 91. And which is really remarkable when you think about it, because it's not that long ago, and we're such a diverse city. And I was the first Asian reporter, I was the first Chinese Canadian reporter. There was an Asian reporter called Rick Matsumoto who was in sports at the Star at the time, but I was the first Chinese Canadian reporter to start at the Star in 1987. Again, not that long ago, and for a city as diverse as Toronto, but I'm glad we've caught up.
Thank you. Lastly, I think I just wanted to ask you about more about work, and what's been the most satisfying. What do you think have been kind of achievements that you're proud of in terms of the work that you've done?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's been 31 years. I'm not sure necessarily what I might be proud of. I mean, I think over, you know, the last 3 decades, I'm glad that I was able to give a voice maybe to some communities that weren't as represented as they should be. You know, it's really been a long struggle, and it's a struggle that's still continuing. So if anything, I guess maybe I'm proud of that. I'm also proud of the Toronto Star itself, and not to give a big ad about this, but they really have cared about issues such as diversity and representation and giving people a voice, you know, truly comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. I really think it's been a brand, and I hope in some small ways I have as well, that has spoken truth to power. So if anything, I think those are the things that really will stick with me, you know, when I'm 6 feet under.
And then also, obviously, this interview is for the Chinese Jamaican Oral History Project. Is there anything I haven't asked you that feels significant to share, or you know, that you would like to kind of contribute from your experience and your voice?
Yeah, no, I'm just glad that you're doing something on this scale, because it's such an unrecognized community, and I think it's time that somebody shine a light on it, and I'm so glad somebody is. You know, when I first came to Canada when I was 11 years old, decades and decades ago, I didn't even know what this peculiar beast was. What is being Chinese? What is being what is it being Jamaican? What is it being Canadian? And at the end of the day, I guess it's all about being Canadian, but it took a heck of a long time to get here, or to have that understanding. And I'm glad that, hopefully that, you know, with the Oral History Project, I think that will contribute to that understanding. I think that's really, really fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.